Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Potuck, one of your hosts for today, here together with Ursula Rutenberg.
Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for joining us.
Today, we're going to talk about the birds and the bees.
Not exactly what we usually think of when the falling of the leaves and the waning of the light is happening and the cold days of winter are setting in. I know a number of us are in the mood that Nobel Prize-winning author Sinclair Lewis expressed well when he said, "Winter is not a season, it's an occupation."
That may be the case, but writer and poet Anne Bradstreet wrote, "If we had no winter, the spring would not be so pleasant. If we did not sometimes taste of adversity, prosperity would not be so welcome." Bradstreet was the first woman writer to be published in colonial America. Her work was influential to Puritans in her time. Actually, a lot of activity occurs in winter and life continues, if perhaps on a more subtle level, and we're hoping that looking at some of the winter activities of the natural world will be a comforting reminder of the natural cycle of things. In the words of Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Steinbeck, "What good is the warmth of summer without the cold of winter to give it sweetness?"
Indeed. And getting back to the birds and the bees, we convinced Pat Schlarbaum, KHOI's bird expert, to stop by on the way to work. Thanks for stopping by, Pat.
Great to be here.
It's always great to have you with us.
But before we get to the birds, just to let you know, later in the show, we will indeed find out what happens to bees in the winter.
And in the last half of the show, we're going to continue talking about the birds and the bees.
That is, the birds and the bees, as in sex education. Where and how sex education is succeeding in our community, from preschool through adulthood.
This edition of Local Talk on KHOI is about the birds and the bees. So let's start with the birds. Pat filed this report recently on one noteworthy bird that has just arrived and is currently with us, the sandhill cranes.
Autumn is always a big time of year for nature. Today's focus on phenology is Iowa's sandhill cranes in autumn. More and more Iowans are hearing new sounds emanating from our wetland marshes. Sandhill cranes also provide an animated display of leaping and calling that occurs whenever cranes congregate. Even in autumn, these marsh dancers provide a fascinating show. After a 98-year absence, sandhill cranes once again began nesting in 1992 at Otter Creek Marsh on the Iowa River just east of Tama. This year, four additional counties have included sandhill cranes in Wright, Hamilton, Howard, and Johnson counties. Cranes have now nested in 26 counties that include the Chautauqua Wildlife Area to our southeast in Polk County and at Anderson Lake in Hamilton County just to our north. Pioneering pairs nesting in Iowa are spilling over from the Wisconsin crane flock. Cranes stand 4 to 5 feet tall and weigh about 14 pounds. Our cranes are greater sandhill cranes, which are slightly different than the lesser sandhill cranes that gather by the hundreds of thousands near Kearney, Nebraska, each spring. In autumn, cranes leave their nesting marshes and begin congregating at only selected locations, like Otter Creek, to our east in Tama County. At first light of dawn, cranes leave their overnight locations to fly beyond the horizon. They look for secluded areas with waste grain to feed upon. Cranes like our corn. At midday, their return flights to the marsh are quite vocal and awe-inspiring. Their six-foot wingspans and tight flight formations create a measured excitement with each passing group. A few autumns ago, while constructing a wildlife viewing platform overlooking the marsh, the crane's midday return provided continuous enjoyment as wave upon wave of 5 to 7 at a time were flying overhead. Eventually, over 130 had been counted. When they land, their bugling calling continues as they joyously leap about. It creates quite a rousing ruckus in the tempered autumn colors of the marsh. So join the fun and leap on over to Otter Creek Marsh to enjoy nature's orchestrations and dazzling dances. Hopefully you'll be serenaded by primal calling of the wild that hearkens an era when thousands of wetlands pocketed the plains. The presence of sandhill cranes, trumpeter swans, Canada geese, and a myriad of wetland waterfowl and wildlife have become welcome additions to Iowa's landscape. They enhance our spirits with hope, and they elevate the quality of all our lives. The marsh dancers are worth it. Try to share the experience with children and friends sometime soon. And that's our Focus on Phenology for today.
Thank you, Pat, for coming in. A sandhill crane is quite a phenomenal creature. Would you describe how they look?
Well, you know, long legs and a long chiseled beak. And that beak is really significant this time of year where they're congregating at places like Sweet Marsh and Otter Creek Marsh. They still go out and feed on our waste grain, but they have to chisel through the ice at some point.
And, so they do that with their beak.
Right.
Their beaks are like pickaxes?
Yeah, pretty much. That's a good way of putting it. And where you see hundreds of thousands of sandhill cranes out in Nebraska, here in Iowa, we're seeing a different type of migration of just family units primarily. So 100 is pretty good.
A sandhill crane is a big bird.
About 14 pounds. Yeah, they stand about 4 feet, between 4 and 5 feet high.
Like a small person.
Yeah.
And when they emit their call, it kind of sounds like a rusty machine trying to start up.
Yeah, a real rattling. It's quite distinctive. It's really considered a primal call, something from back in the pterodactyl era.
Yeah, I first heard it when I was in Wisconsin visiting some friends, and they were around the house, and I thought some machine was broken outside early in the morning.
Yeah.
My friend told me something really amazing about it. She has a Honda, and she was driving the Honda down the road, and a sandhill crane was on the road with her baby, and the crane took on the car.
Yeah.
So
yeah, they're pretty formidable. Yeah. In the rehabilitation world, whenever there's an injured one, you got to watch for that beak. I mean, they're pretty powerful.
It's really something worth seeing.
Oh, I think so. And just having them back in the marshes, you know, they were gone for 98 years. They did nest successfully at Otter Creek in 1992. So they were a long time gone, and sure great to have them back.
Let's talk about another project that's in the works as we're speaking, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Two ospreys that were nested in a crane,
oh, sure.
I think, this summer at the Wells Fargo complex in Des Moines will find their nest atop a new pole when they return in the spring.
Yeah.
According to the Des Moines Register, the birds had built a nest atop a construction crane, and now that the construction is finished, the crane is being removed, and the birds don't know it yet because they've migrated south. So something tells me you have something to do with all of this.
Well, when they return, yeah, we're going to try to make sure that they have that nesting capability. There's been an expansion of osprey nesting in Polk County, specifically, from 4 to 5 nesting pairs now. And this site is in relatively west Polk County, but there are other ospreys in the area. This is really a great thing. The nest activity doesn't occur till like the 3rd or 4th year. So these birds, they were kind of practicing, if you will. They had missed the window of successful nesting because they migrate out of here early in September. So
where did they nest?
Well, they were carrying sticks and trying to establish a nest on some counterweights on the end of a crane, but it's a parallel crane. It's not a perpendicular crane. So this apparatus was up about 300 feet in the air, and there was a gap in the counterbalances, and they started putting sticks in there and fish, and it was really putting on quite a show. And to
and,
the credit.
And the crane wasn't moving?
Yeah, the crane was moving.
And
the crane
that didn't
would move,
bother them?
Yeah, I've got images. Were they just sitting up there just enjoying the world, passing by from a great vantage point? There are 3 fish ponds, landscape ponds, in that general vicinity, and they were full of fish. So it was really the fish in the ponds that started it all. And I might mention, you know, landscape architects like to put water as a feature in a community.
Uh-huh.
And then, lo and behold, when you do, they're hopefully attracting dragonflies and ducks.
And ospreys.
And ospreys now. So
now, osprey is a big bird with very long wings, and they like to be high up because they don't want obstruction from their wings when they're...
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it. You know, they're about a third of the weight of an eagle. People call them fish eagles, but they have a 6-foot wingspan, but they also extract the fish right out of the water. So they're pretty much all wing, and they can't deal with the obstructions of tree branches and things. They always want an open platform, if you will. And by providing that, when they return next spring, if they survive their migration, you know, they're going to do about a 4,000-mile migration to Central and South America. So it's hopeful.
So the least
that,
we can do is...
Right. If they can survive that, I think we can provide them a platform on a pole. And interestingly, today is the third reading. I had to go through the West Des Moines City Council for approval to put this pole. So tonight will be the third reading. We've done it twice. But at every council meeting, there's a multiplier opportunity. First, we recognized White's Construction, who were taking care of those ospreys. And then it was the employees of Wells Fargo. So I'm really kind of assisting those people that have an interest in the ospreys. And then everybody in the West Des Moines City Council, they're all learning about ospreys. So there's quite a multiplier effect going on.
The construction company discovered the ospreys first because it was their equipment.
Yeah.
And then they told Wells Fargo that they had these birds. And then Wells Fargo was willing to build a pole for them to...
Well, we're trying to get that approved. Yeah.
And then the city council has to say that's
right,
okay?
Right, and the city council has
Why does the city council have to say that's okay?
Well, I think it just has something to do with their zoning. You know, you just they don't want people putting up... nest platforms willy-nilly around the community. It was just something that needed their approval.
It's a big pole?
With a platform.
60, yeah, with a platform. It's a 60-foot utility pole with a platform on the side. And the platform is about 4 feet by 4 feet.
Mm-hmm. And it's on the property of Wells Fargo?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah. And
so they're going to have their own mascots?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is really quite a charming enterprise of strengthening wildlife and stewarding a pretty highly charismatic nesting species that just returned in 2003. So we're up to 21 nesting pairs now. So it's a growth in development. We're really promoting the clean water that the ospreys need, the fish, and the fish need clean water. And goodness knows we all need clean water.
And ospreys were extinct from Iowa for a while?
Yeah, they were taken out early on by the European settlers when Iowa was becoming a state, and primarily in northwest Iowa. But yeah, they were gone quite a number of years, but have made a return since 2003.
Why will the ospreys understand that this pole is a replacement for the crane?
Well, it's going to be located in such a way I can kind of predict where they want to perch to look at. They have to look at the water to see the fish, and they'll hover. We're going to put it in a vantage where they can see those three ponds. They'll perch and watching for the fish near the surface. They don't fly underneath the water like a loon or cormorants. They need the fish to be pretty close to the surface when they strike it.
And you're pretty sure they're going to come back same spot?
If they survive the migration, they have established a bond with that territory. That's now.
With Wells Fargo.
Yeah, with those three ponds. And if they survive the migration, they'll return there, and we'll keep our fingers crossed. It'll be a great case study to share with all the listeners.
Tonight is the night where the city council in Des Moines has to say this is okay?
Yeah, they've approved it the two previous readings, and it takes three. So this evening we'll be there basically sharing the love of these birds that are our ambassadors for clean water.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear how wild animals are intersecting with utility poles and construction cranes and the constructs that humans make, highway signs. For the birds, that's just part of...
Fulfills their nesting parameters, and we can do that. We really need to do better on our water quality. I mean, they're here to guide us to do better. And everybody that can realize the beauty of having these birds with us, once again, I think that's the take-home.
The message of the ospreys is...
Clean up the water.
Clean up the water.
Yeah.
Keep the water in Des Moines clean, because that's the water we're going to use.
Right.
Another wonderful place with water is Ada Hayden Park.
Right.
The migration is really fabulously on display right now at Ada Hayden Park.
Sure is. A lot of big white birds and a lot of geese.
A lot of noise, too.
And eagles.
There's a lot of noise out there.
Yeah.
On Friday, we're going to be airing... your recording about migration patterns and what you can see at Ada Hayden right now.
You're right. With Tyler Harms, he's the president of the Wildlife Society here in Iowa, and he's a great birder, and I'm sure the listeners will look forward to hearing Tyler's report out at Ada Hayden.
Okay. Great thing to hear the day after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
It's time for you to go to work. Your alarm has just gone off.
I should be smarter than that.
Thanks for coming in, Pat.
My pleasure.
Yes, thank
you. Thanks for all you do for community.
Yeah, that's a great sound.
Thanks, Kate.
trees are turning, chimney smoke is curling, fallen leaves are swirling, I'll be coming home. When geese are wending, apple branches bending, when the summer's ending, I'll be coming home.
This is Local Talk on KHOI. I'm Kay Potok, here with Ursula Rudenberg. The music you just heard was Coming Home by Peter Meyer, and we're talking about the birds and the bees in winter. I was curious about if and how bees survive in the winter, so earlier this week I asked Amber Anderson and Barr about this. Amber's a hobby beekeeper, in addition to being an agronomist, that's a soil scientist, at Iowa State University. Let's listen. Anderson and Barr, who's a soil scientist and a backyard beekeeper, and she's going to talk to us about, well, bee reproduction and hive reproduction, and also what bees do in the winter, how they get by in the winter, and colony collapse, and if there's a relationship between the winter time and colony collapse.
Well, first we'll talk about how they get through the winter. In Iowa, just like we like to curl up, stay as warm as possible, the bees do too. So they will group up in one big ball in the center of the hive, roughly. And the queen will be at the center to make sure that she stays warm enough, and that center of the hive will be 90-some degrees. Mm. And they really stay close, so they keep each other warm through the winter. Well, that means that their food and such has to be right there. That means that they can't have disease problems because they don't have an opportunity to reproduce very quickly or to fly out and get things if they run out of food. So those are big problems. The hive can also be stressed from mites, either tracheal or varroa mites. The mites really stress the bees so that they are unable to make it through the winter. The next generation of bees will have disfigured wings and things like that.
Now, in terms of having enough food, that means perhaps that the beekeeper shouldn't take as much honey, or maybe shouldn't even take any honey for the winter.
That is one option. Mm-hmm. There are also some commercial beekeepers who will substitute, after they take out the honey, they will put syrup back on. So sugar water back on, so the bees can fill up their hive again.
But that's presumably not as nutritious for the bees as real honey, is
that's,
it?
That is one of the reasons that they say that the nutrition could be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, about the mites, are these mites visible to the naked eye if the beekeeper is looking for them?
You have to be looking fairly closely to see them. They're most easiest to see on developing drones or the male. While they're still in the hive, you have a little pupa stage that they're white, and the mites are visible as little brown to black spots on them. They're easy to see on there, but if you were to just pick up a bee, you'd have to be looking rather closely.
Mm-hmm. But by the time they come out and they're, as it were, fully formed bees, they might have deformed wings and so on because of...
Correct.
So you can tell that way.
But by that time, you have some serious problems.
So what special steps do you take in the winter to take care of your bees, Amber?
Well, if I were a migratory beekeeper, I would pack them up and go to a warmer place. But being as we're stuck in Iowa and we don't have that option, what I do for the winter is put them in a protected place, make sure that there's a grove or something on the north side so they're not going to get a big wind.
Mm-hmm.
I put in an entrance reducer so that they have a smaller entrance, so that they don't have big winds or big snows or anything going in there. Then I wrap the hive with either a quilt, you can use some sort of a colony quilt or a tar paper or something, just to make sure that the beehive can
keep warm.
A little bit warmer.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to keep a hive too warm because then the bees will be active and go through too much honey.
Oh, okay, yes. Well, when they're huddled up in this ball, would you call that hibernation or not?
No, they're still buzzing around. If you put your ear next to a hive, you can hear it buzzing, or at mm-hmm. least you hope you can.
Mm-hmm.
They still do things. If it's a little bit warmer in the hive, they'll start cleaning things up. They'll throw dead bees out the front door.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, they're not hibernator. They're actually buzzing around, and they have to use that buzzing to keep warm.
Okay. That sounds like quite a lot of chores there for the winter.
But then I'm done for the entire winter.
So this is less bother or less work of things to do than when they're active, when they're buzzing around and collecting nectar and so on?
The biggest pieces when they're buzzing around is to make sure that they don't run out of space. So you have to make sure that you are ready to put on a new super, a new box on top for the honey.
Oh, okay.
Whenever they look like they're going to anywhere close to running out of space, or they will swarm and you'll lose half of your hive.
And that, if they've got another box on top or another one, could it be beside it or something? They'd swarm into that one, would they?
I have had an empty hive somewhere in the area that a swarm has found. It wasn't one of my hives that was swarming, but someone had found, and I ended up with an extra hive because of it. So they will find whatever they can that's a good place, and if bees have been there before, all the better.
Okay. Well, we're also interested in bee reproduction and hive reproduction. Now, I know that sometimes bees swarm with the old queen, I believe, not with a new queen.
Correct.
Okay.
If they detect that they're running out of space,
mm-hmm.
the old queen will take off with roughly half of the bees, and the bees who are still left in the hive make a new queen from an egg that the queen just laid.
Okay, maybe we should talk about that first, how they get queens. They get a special food, queen bee jelly, but they have several potential queens being reared, but only one finally makes it.
Well, there can only be one queen. But the hive wants to make sure that they get a good queen. So they raise multiple queens from the little eggs that are laid by the previous queen.
And it's only the diet that makes them into queens, is that right?
So they're fed royal jelly mm-hmm. by the worker bees. Normal bees, I believe, only get that for a day, but the queens get it for much longer, and they develop into a bigger cell, and they develop a little bit different time period than the worker bees. Then mm-hmm. after that queen hatches, comes out, then she needs to go on a mating flight before she can even start laying the eggs. And then it's still going to be a couple weeks before you have new bees in there. So if a hive swarms in a bad time of the year, you might not have enough population of bees to get through the winter. There's not enough bees left.
Yeah, to do the work that's needed for the
hive. To do the work or to keep a big enough ball to keep that queen warm.
Right, yes. Yeah, okay. Now, what about drones? They do absolutely nothing except maybe mate with a queen.
That is their one goal in life.
And is it true that the worker bees, would it be right to call them sterile females?
They are all female, and sometimes you'll get one that attempts to lay and then you end up with all drones because they don't have the drone contribution.
And the drones do.
And they get thrown out in the winter, actually.
Well, they get killed or?
They get thrown out of the hive.
So then they die.
So if it's only one drone out in the middle, it's not going to survive. They really depend on the hive.
But they're not stung to death or anything?
No, they're just expelled from the hive.
Okay, because there's too many of them or?
Because in the winter, there is no need for them. There's not going to be a queen that would be out for mating flights. They're just going to be eating honey without really doing anything.
So they have the mating flight. You know, they get a bit of privacy, as it were, and then they come back and lay their eggs.
Yes.
Does the queen bee, does she just look like a big bee, or does she look like a great big grub, or what?
She looks like a very long bee.
But she's got wings in it, or she must have it.
She has wings, but after she gets back from her mating flight, she really doesn't fly. She doesn't move. She just sits there and lays her eggs. The worker bees wait on her, make sure she's fed, and then take care of everything else in the hive. She's just in charge, I guess.
Well, I also wanted to ask you, Amber, how your bees are coping with this whole problem of colony death, and what are the various explanations for this?
Well, some of the research has suggested that a particular pesticide is making hives weaker. We know that the mites can make hives weaker. There are some people who are suggesting that nutrition is also an issue. So there are multiple issues that didn't used to be problems with bees that are now.
Why should mites be more of a problem now? Just because that's the way it goes? It goes in waves? Or?
I'm not really sure. They may be more susceptible to them because of other issues.
Right. And how are your bees doing?
Well, my bees didn't put out quite as much honey as I would like this year. but they seem to be doing fairly healthy. I have one hive that's a little bit more protected in town that seems to overwinter a lot better than ones that are out further. I guess the time to ask me that question would be in about April or May.
Okay, well, I'll try to remember to do that.
Oh, I am constantly fascinated and constantly learning something. Even after 6 years or so, their bees are always teaching me something new.
I've been talking to Amber Anderson Mbal, who describes herself as a backyard beekeeper. She's also a soil scientist. Thank you very much, Amber.
Thanks, Kay.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees, the flowers and the trees, the moon up above, and a thing called love. Let me tell you about the stars in the sky, the girl and the guy, the way that they kiss on a night like this. When I look into your big brown eyes, it is very plain to see that it's time you learn about the facts of life, starting from A to Z. Let me tell you about the birds and the bees, the flowers and the trees, the moon up above, and a thing called love. Tell you about the birds, the bees, the flowers and the trees, stars in the sky, the girl and the guy, the birds and the bees, the flowers and the trees, anything called love.
I don't believe it.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and that was Dean Martin's version of The Birds and the Bees. And we have been talking about the birds and the bees in the winter.
Which takes us right into our next discussion about what else? Sex education. Every month we feature a local community service organization in our community service appreciation segment of Local Talk. And during November we've been featuring Planned Parenthood. Daniel Hoffman-Zinnell for Planned Parenthood of the Heartland sat down with me recently and described strategies for parents to start conversations with teenagers about making wise sexual choices. This is what he explained.
Could you explain what exactly your duties are at Planned Parenthood?
We are a four-state affiliate at Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. So we are in Iowa, Nebraska, Arkansas, and eastern Oklahoma. And we have health educators throughout the states that provide comprehensive sexuality education in local communities and schools with parents, teachers, youth. We provide a comprehensive sexuality education ranging from healthy relationships, communication, consent, and really focused on preventing teen pregnancy, unintended pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections, and HIV. So we a lot of times work with local partners, and many times that's our local schools, and we go into classrooms and provide age-appropriate, medically accurate, a lot of times research-based or research-informed comprehensive sexuality education. Or we work with other youth-serving organizations, juvenile detention centers, a variety of locations, even our correctional facilities would go in and provide sexuality education.
Okay. Now, I understand that last month, October, was called Let's Talk Month. What does that mean?
Let's Talk Month is it's really just a promotion to parents, grandparents, and other askable adults to have that conversation with their young people that are in their lives. Sexuality education within families really should be lifelong. It shouldn't just be the talk.
Right.
Usually we talk about the birds and the bees. We're moving away from just having that one-time conversation to really starting at a young age to talk about sexuality, and really sexuality in general, is more than just sex. So it's including communication, healthy relationships. And so starting that conversation with our young people is important so that we eliminate the embarrassment, the awkwardness, and have it just be part of normal conversation.
So it's really an initiative to educate the educators, you might say, the parents and the grandparents and so on.
Yes. So parents, grandparents, they're our young people's first educators. That's where we learn all of our information when we're first coming into the our lives. And so we're really providing resources to them, and they can always access them through Planned Parenthood of the Heartland.
What do you think are the really important things to emphasize in talking with your teen about these matters?
So we have a resource that talks about 10 guidelines for talking with our kids about sex and sexuality. And those 10 include reassuring them that they're normal. So we as kids, a lot of times, they want just to feel normal. And so reassuring that they are normal.
Whatever they say, if they say I'm gay or
right,
whatever.
You know. Right, yes. Including all sexualities, all gender identities mm-hmm. as normal. Yep. Building their self-esteem, respecting their privacy, not prying too much mm-hmm. if they feel uncomfortable. Taking advantage of those teachable moments that we talked about. Being clear about our values and let them know that others may have different values, which is okay, but these are our family's values. And a lot of times, abstinence is included in that. And all of our health education, comprehensive sexuality education, we include abstinence as a big piece to what we teach our young people.
A viable, okay thing.
It's the only 100% way to prevent pregnancy, STIs, and HIV. So we really stress that in all of our programming.
But also, I think, sort of emotionally, it might be what people want at some point.
Yes. Yeah. We talk about how abstinence can have emotional benefits because when we have relationships, we tend to we can then focus more on our healthy relationship, have more open communication, and really develop our friendship with our partner.
Exactly,
and so
yes.
It's really another great benefit as mm-hmm. an emotional
mm-hmm.
benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the other guidelines for talking with our kids include avoiding scare tactics, give accurate, honest, short, and simple answers, admit when we don't know the answer, and let them know we don't know, mm-hmm. but telling them that we'll find that resource together. Asking questions even if they don't, and asking open-ended questions so that you open that conversation up a little bit more. Get to know their world a little bit more. Understand what pressures do they feel and what they consider normal.
Right. So bring
it down to their level mm-hmm. and see where they're mm-hmm. at.
Now, avoiding scare tactics. Could you say a bit more about that? Because they should know about the dangers of venereal disease and emotional abuse and they should be on guard against these things.
So we are refraining from showing pictures of STDs and things like that because most sexually transmitted infections, they don't have any symptoms. And so really it's just important to protect yourself and if you do engage in any sexual activity to get tested. So we really refrain from scare tactics because a lot of times with STIs, there are no symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I understand you did a survey as part of this Less Talk initiative. What was the survey? Could you give me some examples of what the results were?
So Planned Parenthood and New York University's Center for Latino Adolescent and Family Health did a national study where they surveyed adults and youth. And some of the results included that 8 out of 10 young people and their parents had talked about sexuality, which is fairly exciting. But over 20% of parents had never talked to their teens about strategies to say no or their values regarding sexual health. And over 30% of parents had never talked to their child about accessing reproductive health care services.
Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing answer the questions as they come.
You know? Right, right. So we at Planned Parenthood of the Heartland really encourage age-appropriate information to be shared with our youth and being straight to the point and answering directly their questions in an honest and open manner. And so you can access resources from us on how to answer some of those questions, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of great teachable moments just in daily life, whether you're watching a TV show or just out in public where you encounter things that would be really great teachable moments to talk about sexuality or sex with our young people and have that conversations in a more authentic and normal manner.
Right, yes.
And a lot of times it's really just talking about relationships. It's mm-hmm. not really talking about the actual sex activity. And so really just talking about how healthy relationships, what they look like, how communication is involved, and how consent is involved so that each party is respected and valued.
Right. Why is it so important to talk to teens about sex and relationships? And is it more important when they're teens than at any other age, say when they're younger?
I think it's important to start the conversation, so talking about relationships with friends when they're younger, and then mm-hmm. once they get a little bit older to ask them more open-ended questions about more closer relationships. Maybe they're having a significant other, things like that. But teens are getting to a point where they're going through puberty, and so they're seeing a lot of changes going on in their body. And mm-hmm. so if we provide them education and information that's medically accurate before they go through that change, then they'll understand why mm-hmm. things are occurring. And they may start to experiment. And it's really important to talk about sexuality and sex and provide them with accurate information on how to protect themselves, preventing STIs and HIV.
What you're interested in Let's Talk, would this include alerting young children about the dangers of inappropriate touch and things like that?
Well, you bring up a really good point that children can also initiate this conversation. So if parents don't initiate it, it's always up to the child, also up to the child if they would like to initiate the conversation.
Well, they often do. They ask questions.
Right. But I think, yeah, it's important to talk about appropriate, inappropriate touch. Some of our programming, we have specific programs where we teach young people about this and what they should do if they experience something like that and who they can talk to protect themselves.
I think some parents say, well, I don't need to talk to my kids about this because they get sex education in school. But I think some parents make that a sort of excuse not to. I wonder what your perspective is on that.
Well, in the state of Iowa, there's a law that requires human growth and development within all schools.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that necessarily that each school provides comprehensive sexuality education. So I think it's still important for parents to talk about sex and sexuality with their youth. And one of the biggest things that our schools can't teach is our own individual and personal values. And so parents have a large interest in educating their young people as to what those values are and what they would like for their young people. And this data did show that 52% had never talked about these values with their youth. So I think it's just really important for youth to understand what their family values are so that they can keep those in mind when or before they would have any sexual activity.
That reminds me, actually, now you say that, I remember talking to my son about this stuff, and he seemed to be poo-pooing and blowing. the whole thing off. But then, I mean, he was still quite young. I was driving him and a friend. They were sitting in the back seat, and he was repeating what I'd said to his friend. In other words, although he sort of blew it off when he was talking to me, he nevertheless took it in and passed it on.
Yeah, so even though youth may not seem like they're listening, they are.
Yes.
And the more you talk about it, the more it'll sink in. But you bring up a really good point about being in a car. So if parents or grandparents may feel awkward or uncomfortable talking about sex or sexuality, going for a drive and talking about it in a car is a great tool because you don't have to look at each other in the face and you're both looking at the road. And so that's just a really great tool that we tell adults, parents,
well,
and grandparents.
Well, I noticed that, actually. I mean, not just talking about sex education,
but
anything. It seems to be easier in the car.
Yes. And they can't escape, so.
Yeah, and as you say, there are lots of teachable moments.
Yeah.
Well, talking about values, do you have any tips about how parents and grandparents or whoever is talking to the teen can help them realize the importance of this?
Well, I think it's first is really just assessing your own personal values and see where you stand. Before you can really educate or talk to your youth about values, you need to know what your own internal values are.
Would you like to talk about the kind of resources that Planned Parenthood has available for parents and grandparents?
So Planned Parenthood of the Heartland has a variety of resources available to parents, grandparents, and teens. And we have a resource center in Des Moines that individuals can access in person. We have a library that's made up of literature, books, movies, a wide range of other options for people to check out. And you can also call our number at 877-811-7526 or visit our website at www.ppheartland.org, and there's just a wealth of knowledge on our website or by calling this number, and there's brochures, books, and also you can access our health educators to come out and provide programming in your local community if you don't feel comfortable doing that.
Oh, okay, so you could come out and talk at libraries and schools.
Yes.
Okay, I'll just repeat the number, 877-811-7526, and we will put it up on our website beside the program. And it was ppheartland.org, was
correct,
it?
Correct, yep.
Okay, good. I've been talking to Daniel Hoffman-Zinnell, who's the Director of Education and Outreach with Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. Thank you so much for coming to us and talking to us today.
We've been listening to Daniel Hoffman-Zinnell, Director of Education and Outreach for Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, giving counsel on how to have conversations with teenagers about sex. He can be reached at the Education Resource Center of Planned Parenthood, and we'll put the contact information up on our website.
Lori Allen is the former Director of Youth and Children's Ministries at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames, and in that capacity, she has led a successful sex education curriculum that caters to youth in grades 7 through 12. She has also been trained in the administration of sex education from preschool through adulthood. So we asked her to come in to tell us what she learned about sex education. Welcome, Lori.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be here today.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. You've worked with us in the past with Porch Stories.
Yeah.
It's great to have you back.
Yeah.
What is this program called, Lori?
We called the program OWL, and that was the acronym OWL for Our Whole Lives. And the curriculum was developed with two denominations, the Unitarian Universalist Association and the United Church of Christ. And the curriculum was the answer to completing the spiritual development of children, because being human includes all aspects of being human, including sexuality and relationships. Some churches may choose to begin as early as preschool, where there's information about self-awareness and about self-image and relationships within the family and with their friends, growing on through puberty and the changes that will happen. And then in middle school and high school, the focus is much more on relationships and about the actual anatomy and physiology of sexuality and reproduction and contraception and choices, and not just choices about sex, but choices about things that influence how your relationships work. Drugs, alcohol, abuse, those types of things are brought up so that there's an awareness. And then with the young adult and the adult curriculum, people are continually sexual beings their whole lives. And so it's just processing, again, the changes in your life and what's happening. And ideally, you would begin this with children when they're 4 years old, and people would be interested in reevaluating the roles that sexuality has in their life continually.
It might be difficult for, it's a bit difficult for me, in fact, for people to imagine what, I mean, other than where do babies come from, which small mm-hmm. children ask.
Well, there's, again, teaching about, wow, what a great person I am, and how, amazing my body is. It can run, it can jump, it can, you know, bend, it can do all of these wonderful things. And we also talk about safety, about how you feel. You feel that something's not right. It's
important. Inappropriate
right.
touch.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff
safety
like that.
Is.
Right.
Yes. And then, of course, you know, puberty, their bodies are changing faster than they know what to do. And at some of the different points in this curriculum, the preschool and the adolescent curriculum, requires parents to be a part of the program so that they will come in and talk to, be a part of the program so they understand exactly what their children are learning and what they're hearing. And then there's times when the children are alone with the educators as well, so they can ask questions the older students may be too embarrassed to ask in front of their parents or something.
Right. Actually, that mm-hmm. was something mm-hmm. I brought. I didn't leave it in the recording.
Right.
I brought
mm-hmm.
up with Daniel Hoffman-Zinnell.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, your parents are the most embarrassing persons to talk about sex to, really, I think.
I think there has to be a relationship built from the beginning of a child's life to know that it's okay and that your parents want to give you the information
sure.
that will help you make good decisions. But you're right. Teens especially want this privacy
right.
that their parents, if you ask, you know, when should I start being sexually active, parents might get worried that that means they are sexually active and they just may want information. And so in the middle and high school program, it's one that the parents do not participate in any of the classes with their teens, but they're aware of the curriculum, they're shown the curriculum and all of the resources before the classes begin. But we do let parents know that confidentiality is an important thing, so we won't be reporting to parents what their children had asked about, if there's something the teachers, you know, raise a flag for them about abuse or unhealthy, you know, interactions, that we'll talk to the student first. But sometimes it's appropriate to let parents know that we have concerns about what's come up in class.
What have you found in your experience to be some of the most important things that come up in communicating? Mm-hmm.
I think it's interesting that, like so many things, you need to hear things more than once to become adept and knowledgeable about things. And we do find that there's really a lack of understanding about how the actual anatomy and physiology works. There's misconceptions about how pregnancy occurs or how contraception works. Especially with our middle schoolers, they're very interested in knowing how to do relationships. And, you know, we did have students who would identify or were beginning to identify maybe as straight or gay or bisexual. Boys wanted to know, what do girls want in a boyfriend? And, you know, girls wanted to know, what do boys want? Or, you know, girls. And so they're very interested in the relationship part of it. And actually the actual, you know, sex, the sexual intercourse was, they were interested in it, but it was more about, how am I going to manage this relationship? Mm-hmm. Like, what, and what's going to be expected of me? And so part of our goal was to help them set really clear boundaries too. It's, you're the one who gets to choose what you feel comfortable with. And we also put out there that as a middle schooler or a high schooler, some of the decisions you'll be making have really big consequences, and that we feel that it's best to postpone any activities that will bring about those consequences, like a pregnancy or a sexually transmitted disease, until you are in a place in your life where you have the resources and the maturity to deal with those things. So while it's not specifically an abstinence-only curriculum, we certainly do promote postponing sexual activity until you figured out the rest of the relationship are mature enough to deal with all of the consequences, intended or not.
Do you find most young people are receptive to that message?
Very receptive. Very receptive. And I feel like they're all just very happy to get the information and to be in such a safe place where any question is okay for them to ask, and where the answer will be given without making a judgment about why they asked the question or where it was coming from.
Well, one hears that there's pressure to have sex much younger than there used to be. Do you find that to be true in your experience?
I think there is always pressure to conform to what
the norm
is.
And what's considered the norm these days?
Well, I think that we've seen that the age of first sexual experience is going back up after going down a couple of decades ago. But one of the things I always like to tell parents is that if you're not talking to your kids about sex and about what your hopes or your values are, that their friends and that even their friends' parents may be bringing it up. So I don't know if I totally recall exactly, but I do believe that first sexual experience for females in the U.S. is about age 17, and for boys, it's about age 18. And so that means, of course, there's a lot who are a lot older, and there's some who are younger. And we do talk about other aspects of sexuality, that, you know, hand-holding and hugging and kissing is an expression of your sexual being as well. And so, again, we're very specific in answering their questions and giving information about ways to show affection without choosing behavior that's going to create a pregnancy or a sexually transmitted disease.
So if I'm a parent, what would your advice be to me in terms of wanting to talk about my child about sex?
I would, just as we heard in the segment before, I would use opportunities like movies or television shows or information that's in the media to bring up the topic and just ask the question, like, do your friends watch this show? And what is the you know, this seems a little unreal to me, or this concerns me, you know, seeing these young people acting in this way. I know it's a movie or I know it's a show, but it gives you a platform for them to know that you are thinking about them and their well-being in this area as well.
What do I do as a parent if I try to initiate this and my child just shuts down, shuts me out?
Mm-hmm. As a parent, I would, again, wait for them to come and ask for information, or know your child, you know, if you think they're trying to ask a question, just come out and say, is there, you know, something that you wanted to ask me about? Some of the concerns we get from parents that are really interesting is parents are worried that their children are going to ask them about their sexual history, you know, and then they'll say, well, how old were you when you had sex? And then that means that, you know, that's okay for me. And what I tell parents is that, you know, you don't need to reveal things. If someone says, how old were you, Mom? You could say, oh, that's an interesting question. Where did that come from? You know, it's a way to open the conversation. And it could be that they watched a movie, or it could be that a friend of theirs is sexually active that they have some concerns about. Just offer those opportunities when they come up. So sometimes it takes them a few tries to ask the question that they really want to ask. Right. And I think it's important for parents to just remember to see their child as the whole child, too. You want to know about their activities. You want to be engaged with them in their activities. You want to be spending time with them, asking them, you know, what are you thinking about these days? You know, because it's not always about sexuality. And I think the more connected to what they're thinking about you can be, you'll have more opportunities to talk openly and to answer their questions and to kind of alleviate your own fears, too.
So that's it for Local Talk. We've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Kay Potok. And today we spoke with Pat Schlarbaum about birds and Amber Anderson Amber Anderson Ba about bees. And to tell us about the birds and the bees, that's sex education. We heard from Daniel Hoffman Zinnel, Director of Education and Outreach for Planned Parenthood of the Heartland, and Lori Allen, who is the former Director of Youth and Children's Ministries at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Ames.
Local Talk was engineered by Rick Morrison. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Coming Home by Peter Meyer and Dean Martin singing Let Me Tell You About the Birds and the Bees. Remember that Local Talk is archived at khoifm.org. So if there's anything you want to go back to hear again, you can find it at khoifm.org. KHOI is also streaming live online at khoifm.org.
We want to give you a brief update on our funding campaign that is currently in effect. It's the end of the year, and we're raising money that we need to operate KHOI in 2015. Our goal at this time has been to raise $40,000 as part of our, which will pay for part of our annual budget by January. So this is a great time for you to join KHOI. Thank you so much to all of you who have joined so far. Seriously, everyone who volunteers to make KHOI happen is more thrilled and grateful than we can express by your support. And because of your participation, we are just a little more than halfway to our goal with around $20,000 raised, actually about $21,000 raised. If you have not joined KHOI yet, please consider doing so before the end of the year. Basic memberships are $40. Premium memberships are $100. And we are looking as well for those of you who can become a sustaining member with a donation of $250 or more. But of course, we're appreciative of any donation that you can make. Please donate online at khoifm.org, or just come by KHOI Studio with your donation or send it in the mail. You can find our address at khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And we are actually becoming hopeful that we'll exceed our $40,000 goal, which means we will be able to spend less time next year raising money and more time doing at KHOI what we love doing best, building community through communication. So thank you for your participation. Without you, we really would just be a few people talking to each other in a nice room. Thank you for your membership, and thank you for listening. And we'll see you again on the radio.